Hello, and welcome to a special edition of Awards Daily's Water Cooler Podcast. I'm your host, Clarence Moy, and today I'm bringing you an interview with Timothy Greenberg, the creator of the upcoming Netflix series Living With Yourself, which stars Paul Rudd. Now, Timothy started his career working on Riven, the sequel to Myst, which if you know anything about gaming, it's a very frustrating game. And of course, he moved on from that to join The Daily Show in 2006, where he won two Emmy Awards under Jon Stewart. But ironically, it was Jon Stewart's departure that sort of kickstarted the thought process behind his new series, Living With Yourself, which originally was conceived as a feature film, but Timothy decided it worked better as a longer series and was eventually pitched to Netflix, who, as we talk about in this interview, has a soft spot for high-concept comedy like The Good Place and its Netflix own original Russian Doll. So will Living With Yourself join Russian Doll and be Emmy-embraced? We'll have to find out, but Paul Rudd stars in this comedy, and he is really fantastic as a man who, let's just say, goes to some unusual lengths to cure that midlife crisis. So kick back and listen to my interview with Timothy Greenberg, again, the creator of Living With Yourself, which drops on Netflix Friday, October 18th. And again, I'm Clarence Moy with the Awards Daily's Water Cooler Podcast. Thanks for listening.
Hi, how you doing?
Hey, Tim, how are you?
Good.
Excellent. Glad to hear it. Happy to talk to you. So one of the things I noticed about you is that you have such a fascinating career trajectory, working from things like Riven, which is quite possibly one of the most frustrating games ever made, no offense, to
winning
Emmys for The Daily Show and now creating Living With Yourself. So what was your philosophy in sort of negotiating all of that? How did you to go from such extremes, or not extremes, but such different, different settings?
I mean, there was no overriding philosophy. You know, it was pretty much a follow, you know, where the path leads. Like each one of those was kind of a, you know, I worked at Riven because I had taught myself how to be like to do 3D animation, and then won this award, and they found me and called me out of the blue, and I was like a huge fan of Myst, so that's how I got there. So each step was kind of pretty random. Other than to say, I tried to work on things that I really liked, you know, like I really loved Myst, so when they called about Riven, I was totally in. And, you know, on The Daily Show, I loved the show, you know. I mean, I was just such a fan, so when we connected, I jumped at the chance. Only more recently have I started to take more actual control and think ahead. Now that I have a family that I have to support, I need to actually think about, like, how am I going to continue to do that? So.
It's incredible what the basic needs, like family and food and shelter, all do to our careers.
It helps. I mean, you know, this show in a way started when Jon Stewart told us he was leaving The Daily Show, and, you know, I was panicked, like, oh man, what am I doing with my career? And then the next morning, I kind of, this idea I'd had previously as a feature, and then I realized, like, standing in the shower the next morning, that I thought it actually would work even better as a show, and kind of that panic of, like, oh, I'm going to be jobless soon, really motivated me to kind of sit down and do this. Although really it was, as soon as I thought of the idea that next morning, I was like, oh wait, this is going to work great. But the timing was, a bit of panic is helpful.
Sure. So what was your original inspiration for the series? Where did the idea come from?
Well, I mean, other than that panic of I need a job, you know, over the years, I'd loved stories like this that were sort of like, what if there were two yous in the world? You know, that's the story that's been done in a variety of ways. But once I got married, and it sort of became more of a daily question as to, like, you know, what kind of person I was and how I was behaving with my loved ones, and why I couldn't always be the best version of myself, and why not? Why couldn't I be? And what was wrong with me for that? You know, and just that struggle, and it sort of became more of a like kind of clear and present issue in my life. I felt like that combined with this idea of what would it be like if there were two of you in the world, really worked well together. You know, like what if literally there was a better and a worse version of yourself, and yet they only had this one life? How would that work? Those kind of the two things, like the more fantastical idea, which I've been kicking around for a while, and then my life catching up and giving me sort of things to write about in context of that fantastical idea.
So, you know, the show lands at Netflix, which, you know, obviously drops it on Friday of this week. So I've seen that Netflix seems to have a really soft spot for high concept comedy. I mean, they've kind of given a kickstart to The Good Place by streaming that there. And of course, Russian Doll premiered earlier this year. And now Living With Yourself, another, you know, very high concept comedy. How was the process working with them? Like, you know, what was it different than working with something like Comedy Central?
We came to them kind of late in the sense that I had originally sold it to IFC and wrote this whole series there. And then it died due to circumstances beyond our control. And I took it back out, and then Netflix now had a whole written season, and they wanted it. So I didn't really develop it there. Once we started making it, they were great, you know, and very supportive, and we all, I think, had a very similar idea of what we wanted the show to be. I can't speak to why they do this, other than maybe that's just their sensibility. I honestly don't know if it's like, if it's the people in the comedy department, their creative sensibility, or if there's also a business calculation that high concept comedies like this might play to a broader audience, like say maybe overseas, you know, where maybe some comedies you need the cultural references, and that in Korea and India, maybe those kinds of things don't play quite as well. So I honestly don't know which it is, but I mean, it works out for me because I happen to love this stuff, you know. Right. I love all the shows you mentioned. I'm happy to be mentioned in the same, that our this show is mentioned in the same breath, because like I love those shows. That's exactly what I like. I even think like I would include Dead to Me to a certain extent, because it's not like high concept, like there's not something magic happening, like say in Maniac or this show, or, you know, but it is something pretty dramatic, you know. Right. And it's one big turn, and it's very, so yeah, I really love that kind of thing.
So one of the great things about the show is the opportunity to see the great Paul Rudd, and not one, but two of him. What was that experience like?
He has incredible control of his performances. I would joke with him, and he would say, I don't know if this is great acting, but it's that you know, that we could say to him, all right, Paul, that take was great, but what we need is like 16% more ennui with like about 38% more realization that the future is maybe not what you thought it was going to be. Also, just make it funny at the end. And he'd be like, got it, and deliver exactly that. I mean, it's incredible how he's been doing it forever, I guess, so he's incredibly talented, or both, and he's very smart, but he just has perfect control. Like, it's unbelievable to see. Like, Jonathan and Valerie, Jonathan Dayton and Valerie Ferris, who the directors would talk about, you know, it's like the difference between driving a Ferrari and not, you know, that like, and just all cylinders are firing, and it hugs the road, and just everything is working, and it's just a joy to work with him, you know.
Yeah, you mentioned Jonathan and Valerie, and so you've got two Paul Rudds and two directors. How was the experience of working with, you know, all the combination of people, but not, you know, Jonathan and Valerie working together? I assume that there's symbiosis between them, but you know, did they particularly gravitate toward one part of the story, or did she perhaps gravitate more toward Kate's storyline, or you know, how was that situation?
No, No, I don't think that they gravitated towards one part of the story or another. I mean, maybe I think they might comment things from a bit more like artistic mm-hmm. angle. You know, they're very artsy in a wonderful way. I maybe secretly am, but I don't like to put that out in the world, you know? So they certainly have sort of like a very refined sense of things. And, I think they have a very nice visual sense. And the music was really very much, they were spearheading that. And I love the soundtrack. I think it's very unique and interesting, you know, Anna Meredith score. But I think the most important thing about our collaboration was that it was a collaboration. You know, I was I wouldn't say I was very concerned. I was thrilled the whole project was happening. But I was in an unusual situation because I, up until then, would usually direct anything I had written. I'd never written anything that somebody else had directed, and the whole notion was kind of bizarre to me. But I'm not an accomplished enough director that Paul was willing to sort of risk it's the first time he's done TV. He wanted the security of having some really established film directors, and he knew them previously. So great. I was perfectly happy to just be the showrunner and the writer, and then they could direct, which is actually, each of those jobs is more than enough. So. But it turned out that the benefit of having a husband and wife team is that they're in constant collaboration. And yes, sometimes they would go off and talk amongst themselves, but they are basically discussing all the time. So it kind of became often a three-way conversation where they're such wonderful collaborators with each other that it was very natural for me to be a part of that conversation. And then for Paul as well, because Paul was equally a creative collaborator in that way. So we all worked very well together, and it turned out, you know, it was a challenge for me to kind of like, here's my baby and now here it is, directors. But in the end, we all worked really like very hand in hand. You know, we were all in the edit room together throughout, and it was just really a wonderful process. We came to really like appreciate them as human beings, as much as directors. So that worked out as great as it possibly could have, as far as I'm concerned.
Right. One of the things I find most interesting about the series is that you're obviously focusing on the human element of the story and not necessarily the mechanics of the cloning process or the sci-fi element of it. You know, it's more about the people and what this change, how this changes their lives. Did you have a backstory for that, sort of the scientific element or sort of the mechanics of the cloning process in case that became an issue? Or is this 100% intended to focus on the human element?
I have a backstory, and I have a logical reason why New Miles is the way he is, and I have a gigantic backstory about how this technology came into being, and there's a reason why the Koreans are Koreans, because South Korea leads the world in cloning, and there's some interesting characters in the cloning technology world in South Korea. So it's all there. That said, there is a very giant magical leap in the middle of it, which is to say there's no technology that can clone a human being in a couple of hours, right. And there's no technology that can transfer memories in a couple of hours either. But if you're willing to go with that, the story is presented as intentional too, so that you don't really stop to think about that, because it's not a science fiction story. It's not truly looking at like what are the perils of cloning. Like that's what the show is about. Yeah.
You know, talking about Miles, which is obviously played by Paul Rudd, one of the things, you know, as you meet him and you know, he develops two personalities through the two different clones. Or, I mean, the two different the clone and himself. He's stuck in a rut. You know, maybe it's an early midlife crisis or you know whatever that is. Is that something that you found yourself struggling with? Is this an output of personal experience? Clearly, you know, don't get too personal, but you know, is this something that you've experienced in your own life, in your own creative world?
Yes, absolutely. Definitely. I mean, I think to some extent at different points in our lives, I'm sure many people have experienced it. Mm-hmm. You know, I experienced it a little bit on a daily basis, you know, it's, fortunes rise and fall, but in the larger scope of my life, there were long periods, you know, of a few years or more where I was just struggling, you know, in terms of my career and in terms of how I thought of myself. And And so in terms of the sort of the career aspect of it and how what he cares about there, I've God knows I've certainly been there. And then in terms of his relationship with Kate, there's definitely echoes of things that my wife and I struggled with early on. I mean, a lot of what's in the show now, we're past. We've got kids now, so it just becomes a whole different thing. And I think we're in a better place having gotten past all that. But there's a lot of all of this that is straight from my own life, yeah. But I think, you know, look, like Paul talks about how he connects with this.
Right.
Paul Rudd. Yeah. Like, he seems like the happiest guy on the planet. As you know, he's a big movie star, and he connects with this. So I think it's got to be somewhat universal. If even Paul Rudd feels this way sometimes, then, you know, then we all must.
Yeah, absolutely. It is a universal truth, whether or not people want to admit it. One of the more shocking things in the series is, of course, without spoilers, is the pig in the crate toward the end of the show. I assume that that's an excellent production. That's an excellent fake. That's not a real pig in that crate. It looks real.
I don't remember, actually. I'm not gonna weigh in definitively either way, because I know there were conversations each way, and I. If it is real, I don't want to get PETA get in trouble with PETA at this late sure. date, or which I sometimes include myself. so I'll just leave that as a mystery as to whether or not it was real. But I really like that bit.
Yeah.
I will say that pizza pigs and that whole little mini storyline, that's very much a real thing. That a friend of mine was basically at one point helping billionaire try to import mangalita pigs from Hungary, and there was some about whether or not they would clone the pigs and this whole thing. So, like, there's a reason why there's that kind of pig, and that Hungarian character of Hilston, like, sent him the pig. Like, that all comes from the real world, actually.
So, last question for you, and thank you very much for your time, and I really like this series quite a bit, and I was happy to talk to you. Season two, what does season two look like? What kind of themes would you explore in a season two?
I mean, you know, first of all, I'm not trying to think too deep about that until Netflix tells us they want it, you know. But obviously, over the past 4.5 years of writing this, I've had a million ideas. I think that there's two things. I think one, I would want to broaden the story to some other characters and perspectives that we haven't really delved into. I do actually think that there's kind of a significant storyline in Korea. I also think that in terms of, like, what does it mean to learning how to live with yourself, I think we barely scratched the surface. You know, Miles and New Miles are not strangling each other at the end. It comes to, at best, a detente. You know, that's hardly, like, any kind of deep self-actualization and realization. I think that the question of, like, how we are living with ourselves, which really means how are we living with others and with the world, has to do with learning how to be not afraid and how to be unselfish and other things. And all that, like, they just barely started that. So I think in terms of, like, the answer to the question of how do you live with yourself, it's like we barely answered that. And I think that there's a lot more to do there, too. But you don't want to get too didactic about it. You know, this whole point of doing this for me is that, you know, I want it to be a fun story. So I think we want to keep it fun in future seasons, too. And I have certainly a lot of ideas about that.
Right. Well, I'm hoping, here's hoping Netflix greenlights season two, because I'm anxious to continue the story, particularly after the last scene. So.
All right. Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. And good luck to you, and best on the future season ahead.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Take care. Bye.